All right, I think it's about time to get started here. So we are looking at the Day of Atonement in this class, and we're not going to be able to cover everything that the New Testament ends up saying about this. The book of Hebrews actually mentions the Day of Atonement. Whenever the book of Hebrews talks about the priest not having to the priest has to offer sacrifice for himself first and then goes into the holy place and everything once a year. Like, those passages in Hebrews are primarily talking about the Day of Atonement. And so Hebrews makes a big deal about that. And unfortunately, we're not going to say a lot about that tonight because there's some other things that we're going to be looking at, primarily going into Leviticus. So that's going to be the plan for tonight. So here's, again, the chart that we've been looking at. And after this Wednesday, that's when I teach the Feast of Booths, and Mason is going to do the final two classes where he's going to couple together the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee, and then he's also going to couple together Purim with Hanukkah. And so that's going to be the plan moving forward with that. And for tonight, let's just remind ourselves of a few things. The purposes of the feast, number one, was to remember God's acts. And why is it important to remember what the Lord has done?
So we can do the same for others?
Right, yeah. So then we're able to, when we remember what God has done for us, it empowers us to be able to do it for other people. It keeps us being thankful to Him. It means that all the blessings that we have, we acknowledge that it's because of the Lord. And, I mean, you can think about maybe somebody coming from the world and their life was in ruins and they had a lot of problems and addictions and all kinds of problems. And then as they start listening to what the Lord says about changing the way that they live and all of these different sorts of things, you can imagine that sometimes somebody might let that get to their head. And they might think that they're better than they really are. And so if you remember what the Lord has done, then it keeps you being thankful because you're remembering those things and keeping your perspective in the right place. So that's the first reason. Second reason is to create national unity, as we've been saying, that if every year the nation of Israel was repeating the same stories over and over again, that it would create a kind of cohesion for the people. You might have individual people in the nation of Israel that had little disputes about land or had little disputes about how they had treated one another and things like that, much like you could have in a local church at times. But if you can draw a bigger circle around the little fights people might have by remembering what the Lord has done in these feasts, then you're going to create a greater sense of cohesion. And so we see that going on there. And then thirdly, These all foreshadow Jesus. They're looking forward to what he was going to do and what he's done for us. And so we live on the side of those who have benefited from what he's done. And so that's an encouraging thing for us. I want us to think about, and I want to hear what people have to say about this. And I said this a couple weeks ago, I think, a couple classes ago. But if someone was to ask you, do Christians keep the feast today? What are a couple ways that you could respond to that question with?
I think we're going to say that we keep the feast in the way that they were conceived, that the events of the Old Testament were just an act that they went through, which actually pictured the real feast that we observe.
Okay, good. Good. What else can we say about that question?
I think you had brought up 1 Corinthians 5:8, where it talks about the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth.
Right.
So sort of from the heart, as opposed to the act of, you know, sacrificing animals, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. Mason had brought that text up in one of the first classes that we did. And that sort of helps us understand that when when we partake of what Jesus has done for us, we're keeping the feasts not in their shadow forms, but in their fulfillment in Christ. And so there's a sense in which we keep them, there's a sense in which we don't. And hopefully this class, one of the ways that it's helped us is changing the way that maybe we talk about how we keep the feasts and maybe added some things to our religious vocabulary for some of those discussions. So for the Feast of the Day of Atonement, which is, ironically is not a feast, here's what we're going to do tonight. We're just going to look at the instructions in Leviticus 23. We're probably not going to read those ones. And then we're going to focus primarily in Leviticus 16. And so that'll be the plan for tonight. And before we do that, just a couple more reminders. As we look at this chart, the Day of Atonement is the second of third feasts in the seventh month, seven being a very important month. This is the most solemn day of the year for the Jewish people. Because it was the day that their sins were atoned for. They had 10 days after the Feast of Trumpets to think about their sins and get ready for this day. This was the one day in the year that the high priest could enter the most holy place, like the New Testament will say. And then this idea of making atonement is to make reconciliation. Some people have looked at kind of the words of atonement, and this is probably just a creative sort of way, but etymologically is probably not true to the original languages. But the word atonement is made up of three words: at one meant, like the idea that you've been made at one again, is how some people have at least talked about that. Anybody have anything that they want to say about the meaning of the word atonement?
I've got a sermon I could preach on it.
All right, go for it.
I don't have time. We don't have time for that.
Okay.
But, it's not used in the New Testament, I don't believe, correctly at least. It's an Old Testament idea that is probably covered by propitiation in the New Testament.
Yeah.
But it in the Old Testament, it had something, the idea of covering sins and covering those who were sinners for protection.
Right. Yeah, and this would be for the unintentional sins, like the sins that are done with the high hand, like Numbers 15 talks about. Those ones would be met sometimes with execution. So this was for, this kind of like covered the sins for the people that maybe they weren't even aware of, stuff like that for the year. So very good. I'll say one thing about this here. As we look at the autumn feasts, you'll see that Hebrews 9 and 10 especially are going to pick up on the Day of Atonement. And so we're probably sick of that chart, so I'll move on to this new one. Look at this cool new chart. So if you were to make some comparisons and contrasts between the Day of Atonement and Passover, just I think comparing and contrasting things just helps solidify certain things in our minds. So here's just a couple of interesting things to say about Passover and the Day of Atonement. So Passover takes place during the first month of the religious calendar. Atonement takes place during the first month of the civil calendar. During the Passover sacrifice, it's a lamb, and it was chosen on the 10th day of the month, but slain on the 14th. On the Day of Atonement, you've got a bull and a goat. There's actually a couple more sacrifices for the priests and stuff like this. But you've got sacrifices slain on the 10th day of the month. So it's not selected on the 10th day of the month and then slain 4 days later. It's slain on the 10th day of the month. For the original Passover anyways, the congregation participated by putting the blood on the lintels of the door and everything like this. Later on, when it was commemorated, the high priest or the priesthood was offering a lot of the lambs and stuff like this. But the Day of Atonement is pretty much largely carried out by the high priest and then the runner of the scapegoat. So you've got blood involved in both of these, blood on the doors for Passover, and then atonement blood is taken within the veil to the mercy seat and sprinkled on there. Passover has no scapegoat. Day of Atonement does have a scapegoat, and that's only a festival that has something like that. Anything that anybody wants to say just by comparison and contrast between the two? I don't know what value that adds, but I think it's just helpful to compare and contrast things sometimes to help us remember stuff. Right. So with that being said, we're not going to read Leviticus 23, 26 to 32. I want to read more of Leviticus 16. But let me just highlight a couple things that the instructions in Leviticus 23 do. In this passage, there's a special emphasis given to the Day of Atonement being a special day of Sabbath. If it wasn't on a Saturday, it was going to be one of the extra Sabbath days during the year. And so verse 28 says, you shall shall not do any work. Verse 30, the person who works is going to be destroyed. Again, verse 31, you shall do no work. And then 32, it shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest. And so Leviticus 16 mentions that it's a day of rest, but I think it only mentions it one, maybe two times. Leviticus 23 comes around and really emphasizes that there's no work to be done on this day. Which I don't know if there's any lessons in that, that this is the day that your sins are atoned for, and you don't work, don't work, don't work, don't work. Your work can't accomplish this. I think it's more so talking about economic work and how it needs to be a day that's set aside for that. But that's something that's emphasized in Leviticus 23. It's also emphasized in Leviticus 23 to afflict yourself on the Day of Atonement. Anybody know what it means to afflict yourself in Leviticus?
I think that's a fast.
Yeah, the idea of this is being, it means fasting. And you got passages like Psalm 35, verse 13, uses the same word to explicitly connect it to fasting. So you've got that there. It makes it clear in Leviticus 23 that it's going to be a 24-hour fast from the time that the sun goes down, and then the next day when the sun goes down, then you can eat after that. So it's a 24-hour fast. And I think one lesson to learn from this is that the Day of Atonement, what God was teaching the people, is that sin should cause us to mourn. That sin is not something that we celebrate. Sin is not something that causes us to want to feast. It's something that should cause us to mourn. So like when Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Or when James chapter 4 talks about let your joy be turned to mourning and your laughter to weeping, in that kind of language, that this would have been training the people. The act of abstaining from food would train them to understand how serious sin is. And so that's another emphasis that we see here. One lesson from this that could be a bigger lesson is just that serving God involves denying ourselves, sometimes of pleasures, sometimes of freedoms, all kinds of different things. And so he was, I think, also teaching them that in there. Leviticus 23 also mentions that there's going to be food offerings, and those are further explained in Numbers 29, which we're not going to take the time to look at that in this class. But one thing I'd say about the food offerings, I don't know if you've read much from ancient pagan literature, but when the people in the ancient pagan religions would offer food offerings to their gods, it was to like keep the gods satisfied so that they weren't hungry anymore. What's the difference with offering God food offerings as opposed to what the pagans would have done? Anybody have any ideas on that? This is a minor point, but it's something that happens a lot in the feasts. How is God asking for food offerings different than in the pagan religions?
Are you referring to what the is set aside for the priest?
No, like, okay, so that'd be part of it. Maybe is what's given to the. There's some things that are given to the priests, and maybe you didn't see that so much in the pagan religions. I'm not sure about that one, but there was kind of a sharing with the priests, and that might be a difference. Anything else?
It would be a recognition that everything came from God, who needs nothing from us in the way of food, but it just recognizes that what he gave us really came from him, what we have.
Yeah, good. That would be one thing. I think also like the idea of eating and communing, which these feasts are oftentimes involving, it's emphasizing the covenantal relationship. It's not emphasizing that God is hungry and he needs food, otherwise he's going to kill you. And so those are some things to think about. Ironically, God is given food offerings on the same day that the people are supposed to abstain from food. So, all right, so that's Leviticus 23. Anything that you guys want to say just about that? We covered those instructions quickly, but Leviticus 16 gives us more instructions, more detailed.
Hey, Eric, I imagine you're familiar that the NASB actually, instead of the word afflict, uses the phrase humble yourself or humble your soul.
Right. Yeah, and the idea of that is fasting. So, and fasting would certainly be one way that you can humble yourself. So, yeah. Cool. All right, so Leviticus 16. We'll spend the rest of our time here and then draw parallels between this passage and things that the New Testament says about Jesus. So just a couple general things as we begin Leviticus 16. Interestingly, Leviticus 16, the chapter of the Day of Atonement, is at the center of the Pentateuch. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Leviticus is the middle book of the Pentateuch, and chapter 16 is about the middle of the book of Leviticus. So this is like the heart or the center of the first five books of the Bible. So that's just an interesting thing to see about that. The word atonement is used 16 times in Leviticus 16, so that's easy to remember that. Also, the rest of the book of Leviticus is going to shift to more social concerns like loving your neighbor. It's going to talk about sexual purity. It's going to talk about keeping the feasts like we're looking at. The motivation to obey the rest of the book of Leviticus would be the fact that your sins were atoned for. And so those are just some general things about Leviticus 16. Let's start out by reading Leviticus 16, 1 through 10. And what these first verses do here, they give a general overview of what the rest of the chapter is going to expand more on. So what I'm going to do is I'll read Leviticus 16, 1 through 10, and then make just a couple observations, and then we'll keep moving our way through the text because it's going to expand on a lot of the things that we otherwise would. So look at verses 1 through 10. The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they drew near before the Lord and died. And the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron your brother not to come at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat that is on the ark, so that he may not die. For I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat, but in this way Aaron shall come into the holy place, with a bull from the herd for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. And he shall put on the holy linen coat, and he shall have linen undergarments on his body, and he shall tie the linen sash around his waist and wear the linen turban. These are the holy garments. He shall bathe his body in water and then put them on. And he shall take from the congregation of the people of Israel two male goats for a sin offering and one ram for a burnt offering. So you see five sacrifices there in total. Look at verse 6. Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering for himself and shall make atonement for himself and for his house. Then he shall take the two goats and set them before the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And Aaron shall cast lots over the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other lot for Azazel. And Aaron shall present the goat on which the lot fell for the Lord and use it as a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell for Azazel, or the scapegoat, shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement over it, that it may be sent away into the wilderness of Azazel. Okay, a couple things to notice just about the first 10 verses here. First of all, Nadab and Abihu, this chapter begins by referencing Nadab and Abihu. And I think it's because the instructions for the Day of Atonement came right after the events of Nadab and Abihu. But we had a few chapters in between these things. And so mentioning Nadab and Abihu here would show you that the seriousness of everything that is being commanded here is very high. Because you're going to be entering into the most holy place. Nadab and Abihu didn't come before God and honor him like they should have. And so that's true all the time. It's especially true on the Day of Atonement. And so that's how this begins. But you notice in verse 4 that what is it that the high priest is supposed to wear on this day? What was that?
Linen garments.
Yeah, linen garments. So he's supposed to wear linen coat, linen undergarments, linen sash, and linen turban. Like, so in other words, all of his clothing is all white. Now, this is the high priest. If you go back to the book of Exodus, the high priest had even more ornate clothing than all the other priests. So it's ironic that the one day when he gets to draw closest to God, he doesn't dress up, he actually dresses down. Anybody know why that might be the case?
Would it be humility before God?
Yeah, I think part of it is humility. I think Sewell was saying something too. You were muted though, Sewell.
I was just saying that on the days that he does not go into the most holy place, he's representing God. But when he goes into the most holy place with his sacrifice, he's representing the people and their sin.
Right.
That's a possibility, I think.
Yeah, and the color white represents purity. Now, I'll go ahead and say this now. But after he makes these sacrifices, what will his white clothing look like?
Spattered with blood.
It's going to have blood all over it. So what would that signify to the people if they saw him? What would that signify to the high priest?
Their sin.
Yeah, this is how ugly sin is. You get a guy wearing all white, and then he's going to get blood all over him. I think maybe as a living picture to show you that you used to be pure, but your sin has caused all of this blood to have to be spilled. Now, we'll come back and say more about the linen cloths as we go through this. But he also mentions in this text this situation with the goats, that he's going to cast lots. One of them is going to end up being a sin offering, which verses 15 through 19 expand on. And then the other one is going to go into the wilderness, which verses 20 through 22 is going to expand on. So we'll say more about that in a little bit. Let's shift then to how he expands on the sacrifices for the priests themselves, or for the high priest in particular. He has to take the bull offering for himself first, just like Hebrews says that the priest has to do, but Jesus doesn't have to do that because he's already pure. But I want to skip down to verse 13. Look at Leviticus 16, verse 13. And it says, "And put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of the incense may cover the mercy seat that is over the testimony, so that he does not die." Okay. In verse 2, I didn't say anything about it yet, but in verse 2, it talked about having a cloud over the mercy seat. What's the reason for the high priest offering this incense so that the incense goes before the mercy seat and clouds it over? What's the purpose of that?
That's where the presence of God was, and I think it's so he wouldn't see him.
Yeah. What would happen if somebody saw God in his glory? Well, they would die. The veil, or the cloud, is creating, in a sense, this sort of barrier so you can't see God in all his glory. I like the illustration of a lampshade. A lampshade allows you to still see the glory of the light bulb, but it hides some of it so it doesn't hurt you. So like when God is coming on Mount Sinai, why is there lots of smoke? Well, it's not to scare the people. It's actually to make the people less scared. Because it was, otherwise they would have seen more of his glory than they did. And so when Jesus comes in the form of flesh, it's like the human body was the veil for his true glory, that sometimes he kind of flexed his spiritual muscles, like Mount of Transfiguration. And he showed some of the glory that he had, but here the mercy seat's supposed to be obscured so that you don't see all of God's glory. That would have, I think, helped the priest approach him with more humility in that way. Anything you guys want to say up to verse 14? All right. Let's say some things about the sacrifices for the people. This breaks up into two parts. So first of all, you've got the sin offering, and then you're going to have the scapegoat. And so the offering would be made, the blood would be sprinkled on the mercy seat. Notice that in verse 16, look at verses 16 and 17. "Thus he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the people of Israel and because of their transgressions, all their sins, and so he shall do for the tent of meeting which dwells with them in the midst of their uncleanness. No one shall be in the tent of meeting from the time he enters to make atonement in the holy place until he comes out and has made atonement for himself and for his house and for all the assembly of Israel." So this day of atonement even atones for the holy place itself, which is an interesting thing. Like maybe if people accidentally had touched it and they shouldn't have, or some kind of thing like that had happened. So the atonement takes place for that as well. But in verse 17, could anybody see the high priest doing the work that he was doing inside the temple or the tabernacle? Yeah, nobody could see that. So what do you guys think it would have been like to be one of the Israelites, perhaps gathered around the tabernacle or gathered in the gathering places when all of this was happening? What would it be like to be one of them?
A bit of wonder. What's he doing in there?
Yeah, what's he doing in there? Is everything working the right way? Legend has it that they would tie a rope around them in case they died and they could be drug out. And the priest had bells on their clothing, and so perhaps that was so that they could hear them doing some of the work they were doing or something like that. Can you guys think of any parallels between the Israelites not seeing the work of the high priest and what we have in Jesus? Anybody see Jesus when he died? Did anybody see him go into the most holy place in the spiritual places and make atonement for us? None of us saw any of that, but we trust that he's done it, just like the Israelites would have as they were watching these things from the outside. And so that's what's happening as the sin offering is being made. Anything you guys want to make, any observations you want to make about that one? All right, let's move to the scapegoat then. So let's read this one. Let's read verses 20 through 22. And when he has made an end of atoning for the holy place and for the tent of meeting and the tent of meeting and the altar, he shall present the live goat, and Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the iniquities of the people of Israel and all their transgressions, all their sins. And he shall put them on the head of the goat and send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a man who is in readiness. The goat shall bear all their iniquities on itself to a remote area, and he shall let the goat go free in the wilderness. Okay, so here's the scapegoat. Before it was sent off, what would they do with this goat?
Well, there were two goats to begin with. They had to choose which one was sacrificed and which one was the scapegoat.
Right.
I don't know if that's what you were looking for.
Okay, well, that's part of the procedure. What would they do, like, right before the scapegoat is sent out?
Oh.
Confess.
Yeah. No, I want you to notice this. I don't know how important this detail is. I think it might be important, though. They lay both of the hands on the goat. This is in contrast, by the way, to the regular sacrifices where they lay one hand on the animal. So I don't know if you've ever thought about this before. This is something that, but until I studied Leviticus 16, I hadn't given much thought before. They lay both hands on the goat that's a scapegoat, and they explicitly confess their sins over this one, but they don't explicitly do that over the other animals. And so some people have suggested that if laying the one hand on the regular sacrifices was a way of transferring my sin to the animal, well, what would that do to the altar upon which it was sacrificed? Would that defile the altar if my sin has, even in a sense, metaphorically transferred onto an unblemished animal? This is the only animal in the Old Testament where it's explicitly stated that the sins were confessed over the animal, and then that animal bore the sins away from the altar. And so that's at least interesting to see that. But this idea of confessing, you're not going to be forgiven unless you confess. And 1 John talks about the need that if I have sins that I'm aware of, that I need to be confessing those things before God for me to have atonement made for my sins. But verse 21 gives the three primary words in the Old Testament for sin. So the first one is iniquities, which I think emphasizes the perversity of the act. Transgression, which I think emphasizes the rebellion. And then sin, I think emphasizes that something was offensive. All right, so I have a question about this. Which image does Jesus fulfill, the sin offering or the scapegoat image?
The scapegoat?
Any other answers?
Both, really.
What?
doesn't he fulfill both?
Yes. Yeah, he fulfilled both. So it takes two animals to fully picture what Jesus is accomplishing. So not only has Jesus become the sin offering that can atone for our sins, but you also need the scapegoat that bears the sins away from the camp. And you notice that in verse 21, that it has to be a man who is in readiness that can run with the goat, like you got the goat runner. The guy had to have been a fit person. Can you imagine, like, I don't know what kind of drawing they would have had or something to determine who was really fit to be able to go run with the goat. But I would imagine that would have been an interesting thing that they would have had to pick every year for this festival. But Jesus, it takes both of these pictures to show us what it is that Jesus has done for us. And so anything you guys want to say just about this, how either of these sacrifices function or how they work? All right, let's look at the concluding instructions in verses 23 through 28. Then Aaron shall come into the tent of meeting and shall take off the linen garments that he has put on when he went into the holy place and shall leave them there. And he shall bathe his body in water in a holy place and put on his garments and come out and offer his burnt offering and the burnt offering of the people and make atonement for himself and for the people. And the fat of the sin offering he shall burn on the altar. And he who lets the goat go to Azazel shall wash his clothes and bathe his body in water. And afterward he may come into the camp. And the bull for the sin offering and the goat for the sin offering, whose blood was brought in to make atonement in the holy place, shall be carried outside the camp. Their skin and their flesh and their dung shall be burned up with fire. And he who burns them shall wash his clothes and bathe his body in water. And afterward he may come into the camp. Okay, so notice a couple things with this. So after these sacrifices are made, notice that the high priest leaves his linen garments inside the holy place. We mentioned how the white linen would become bloody. Anybody note the significance on why the linen garments would be left inside the holy place, or what Jesus does with that kind of imagery?
I don't know if you're talking about this, but he left the burial garments were still inside the tomb when they found it empty.
Okay, good. Look at this in John chapter 20, verses 5 through 7. And stooping in to look, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter, this is in the tomb. Then Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb. He saw the linen cloths lying there. And the face cloth, which had been on Jesus' head, not lined with the linen cloth, but folded up in a place by itself. Now, when the Gospel of John three times makes an emphasis there that in the tomb, the linen cloths, linen cloths, linen cloths, do you suppose that that's hearkening back to what the high priest would have done in the holy place, where he was supposed to leave the linen cloths there because the work of atonement had been accomplished now? So I think that's one interesting connection that we can make between those two things. Anything you guys want to say about that? All right, so then after that, you have some bathing rituals. The high priest has to bathe, the goat runner has to bathe, and then the one who brings the goat remains outside the camp and burns them. He also has to bathe, and so you've got all of those pictures about becoming ritually clean. The text ends in verses 29 to 34 just with some general instructions, but it says three times that this day will be a statute forever, a statute forever, a statute forever. And just as a side point, have you guys ever had somebody show you some passages in the Old Testament about how the Sabbath day was going to be a statute forever and how therefore we better keep doing this all the time because it says something like that? Well, we know that, like, scholars all understand, for the most part, that we don't keep doing the Day of Atonement anymore because Jesus has fulfilled it. So it uses the same kind of language like it would for the Sabbath, but what we know this has been done away with in the literal way that they did it in the Old Testament. And so Jesus has fulfilled all of that imagery, just like he has with the Sabbath, how Jesus is the place for rest and everything like that. So, all right, so those are the events that happen on the Day of Atonement. I just want to bring up a couple passages in the New Testament just to make some final connections here. The first one being Mark 15, verses 37 to 39. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." What's the significance of this veil being torn when Jesus was on the cross?
All can enter in.
Yeah, this idea that everybody can now enter into the presence of God when before you could only do it once a year. After Adam and Eve were evicted from the garden, what did God use to block the entrance?
Cherubim
with the flaming sword. What was woven into the tabernacle veil, or the temple veil between the holy place and the most holy place?
Cherubims.
Cherubim were. So, but with the tabernacle, there was more access to God than there was before the tabernacle. Because with the Garden of Eden, there's nobody that's getting back in there. But at least with the tabernacle, you're getting back once a year. And so for a period of time, there was more access, but still very limited. But then when it gets torn from top to bottom, then, like, this Gentile is now confessing, showing that anybody can come into the presence of God now because of what Jesus has done. And then connected to that, you've got Hebrews 10, 19 through 22. "Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us, through the curtain, that is, through his flesh, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water." And then that's where it goes on to say, stir one another up to love and good works and all of that sort of thing. But because Jesus, through his flesh, has opened up this greater way for us, how much more zeal and how much more encouragement should we have for doing everything that the Lord has asked us to do? And so, I know we've not talked about a lot of other things that we could talk about. So are there any other things that you guys want to bring up or comment on from this?
I have a question.
Okay.
Like, what would be the emotion of the day? Would it be, would this would be a very, would the people mourn? I mean, they would probably be mournful all day, and then after the... Do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah. So it's kind of like asking the same question about the Lord's Supper. Like, how should you feel at the Lord's Supper?
It's a range of motion.
Right. Which is one reason why, like, you don't have kids maybe partaking of the Lord's Supper, is because they can't appropriate properly all the emotions that they would need to have to partake of it the right way. There's sorrow, there's joy, there's hope, there's all these different kinds of things bound up with it. And I would have to guess that for the Day of Atonement, it would be similar to that. But I'm not aware of any writings of Jewish people, I'm sure there are, or passages in the Bible that would say something. But the overall tone, at least from what we can see in the Bible, is that you're fasting. And so there seems to be mourning over your sin. And then the next feast, which is the Feast of Booths, is the most joyous feast, it seems, out of any of the other ones in the Bible. So if joy follows after this, maybe not the same day, maybe the same day. I don't know the answer to that, though.
Okay.
Anything else you guys want to say about any of this? All right. Well, that's the feast of, or the Day of Atonement, which is not a feast. but one of the holy convocations for the Israelites. By the way, so on Wednesday, that's the last class that I'm teaching in this. If anybody has any ways that they would like think that this class could be made better or whatever, let me know. Because I think there's some people that want it taught in another setting or in another segment or whatever. So if there's anything that's like still been really obscure, or if you thought the class has been more of like a waste of time than anything else, let me know. And then I can augment things as it needs to be augmented. And that'd be helpful for us moving forward with it. But that's what I have for this class tonight, unless anybody has any final comments. All right, so we'll be streaming a sermon from Sewell in a little bit. So thanks for your guys' comments, and I'll see you on Wednesday for the Feast of Booths.
Thank you, Eric.